ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming. We did try to stay weekly. The news said no. So 5 days a week it is. I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doog, and now joined by esteemed colleagues Latika Burke and Kylie Morris. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
AI seems to be absolutely everywhere at the moment. And while we're still waiting for the productivity revolution or the jobs apocalypse that people have been predicting, the levels of investment are staggering. Elon Musk is even talking about building data centres in space. But down here on Earth, today, the energy costs of AI are already staggering. So how should we think about those environmental impacts? And what can we learn from previous turns of the great technological wheel? This is Lab Notes from ABC Radio National. I'm Jonathan Webb, and today I'm joined by renewables expert Dr. Niraj Lal from the ANU. G'day, Nij.
G'day, Jono. Good to be with you.
What's new in your lab book? What does it say at the top of your latest page?
One of the things I'm looking at is the forecasted consumption of data centres in Australia at the moment. It's an interesting area. Currently, only little. It's around 2% of Australian energy use, but forecast to be more within the next 5 or so years, about 6%, and within the next 10 or so years, rising even higher. It currently is about 20% of Ireland's total electricity consumption.
20% in Ireland.
That's right. It's more than urban household demand. Data centres are powering more.
Why in Ireland in particular is it so high?
Well, they had a lot of investment. The tax arrangements in Ireland supported a lot of investment from technology companies. A lot of them are based there, or at least their tax registered organisation headquarters are based there. And now that capital is shifting. Australia is now, last year was the second largest place for investment in data centres, second to the US. So it's growing here too. We have cheap electricity, and it's getting cheaper if you're connected to wind and solar. So it's an attractive place for data centre investment.
And is that just going to keep growing, that track of building more data centres and needing more energy?
I mean, I think that's the question for humanity a little bit. I mean, if we don't think about it, yeah, it will likely do so, and it will likely continue to increase how much it draws from our grids collectively, and we'll have to build out our grids to manage that. In your intro, you said, everyone today knows and remembers a world without AI. We didn't have it, and kind of life was okay. Like, we got a lot of stuff done, and everything felt pretty quick, and we were always in a bit of a rush, but, we got a lot of things done. And then in 10 years, 20 years, people will look back and be like, oh, how did we ever survive without AI? Just like we asked the question today, like, how do we survive without emails or internet or
air conditioning?
All of these things, exactly. Or like packaged food or refrigeration. And I mean, this is part of the kind of evolution of the human experience. But there are moments, I think, where it's okay to pause and ask, to what end are we driving these technological advances? And what are we willing to take on as a cost? And so there's some irony in, using AI for biodiversity conservation and for solving the world's climate change issues, because in some sense it supports that greater system of growth and consumption and onward technological expansion that feeds the system which is responsible for some of our biodiversity decreases and some of the current kind of climate crisis that we're in today.
In terms of technology meaning that we can do more, but that we need more energy to do it, and that cycle, we have seen this before, if we look back through humanity's history, haven't we?
We've seen it so many times. Recently, with lighting, we now have LED lights, and they're great. They're super efficient, nowhere near as hot as the ones I grew up with back in the day. And it was predicted to lead to like a drastic tenfold decrease in how much electricity we use for lighting. But actually, it turns out we just use more lights now, and we light more things. And
we've just turned on more lights, and we're using the same amount. Is that what's happened?
Yeah, that's right. And same with computing, and same with cars, and same with actually go all the way back. Really fascinating economist that I came across recently. Name is William Stanley Jevons. He was a UK economist and a mathematician. So the UK was using a lot of coal for a whole bunch of different things. It was the steam industrial revolution, and then James Watt's steam engine came along. So it was a time when people in the UK were like, oh, gee, we've kind of exhausted all the easy coal beds. We've scratched out all the ones that are simple to get, and we're now really reaching the end of our supply. What are we going to do? Because we use coal in so many different ways. The steam engine is wonderful. It's providing so much benefit to society. There's a new coming steam engine. And then James Watt came along and he's like, oh, I've got this really new, more efficient steam engine. Uses way less coal. And I was like, oh, James Watt, you are like an environmental savior. You know, you've come found a way to reduce the amount of coal that we use.
I think I can see where this is going.
Yeah, exactly right. And so it was a wonderfully efficient machine, but it just really increased the use of coal across the country and then across the world. And then it was later replaced by oil. And now we're kind of in the process of replacing it. There's a lovely quote from William Stanley Jevons. He says, he wrote, "It is wholly a confusion of ideas to suppose that the economical use of fuel is equivalent to a diminished consumption. The very contrary is the truth." It's very true. I mean, it was true for coal, for any fuel that we use, and similarly for electricity. So, my day job's working in electricity, trying to have more renewables into the grid and making it more affordable and efficient, secure and reliable. But there is a very real awakening, certainly for me, that the more efficient we make it, the cheaper we make electricity, it's wonderful, and hopefully we can do something to help with the climate crisis. But we're fueling the engine of the economy in some kind of way. The cheaper we make things, the more they're going to be used. You build wider roads, you get more cars. And it's a question, when we start to push up against some of our planetary boundaries of consumption, we're speeding up the engine as we increase our efficiency. And we should be aware of that. I'm certainly becoming more aware of that as a scientist and as someone working in this field.
What does all of this mean for our quest for net zero? All of these energy-hungry data centres, we are transitioning to renewables. That might mean that the sort of environmental cost overall comes down, so we put in even more data centers. What's the bearing of all of this, do you think, on our push for net zero, whether it's in 2050 or after that?
If the demand increases, then the goalposts shift. To reach 82% or 100% or whatever it needs to be, we'll have to do more. And I've worked a long time in solar energy, and I think it's really great. And there's a lot of rooftops that we can cover with solar panels. I think that's pretty cool, and we should. But it's a bigger question about large-scale industrial energy farms that we are increasingly building across the country. They do have an impact, and they do affect the communities that are close to them. And that is real. And where do we end in this kind of exponential growth of use and demand? Is it covering every available surface of the planet with solar panels to feed better chatbots? Is that what we really want? And I think we should ask that question.
Does that mean tapping the brakes slightly on some of this what feels like relentless AI investment and infrastructure?
I think systemically it's challenging. I think there's so many captains of industry and treasury coffers that want to be filled and paid, and there's the machine there that has very high inertia. But it's a question whether individually it's something we would consider. I think part of the social media pushback, the conversations around it, are questioning the adoption of technology and what it's doing to us. And I mean, I don't think no one's going to be AI banning for adults anytime soon. But I mean, it's a question for kids, how they are going to interact with AI chatbots of the future and AI therapists and AI companions.
AI bedtime stories.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Yeah. I don't want that engagement being driven up. I want my kids to go to sleep. don't make it more engaging, make it less. If they can tune it to like making them go to sleep, well, then that's maybe I'm interested. But
tuned, slightly dull AI bedtime stories.
Exactly. Build your solar farm for that. I'll take it. No, I think it's a question. I think more and more as I get further and further in my technology journey, I have more respect for the Amish and the Luddites and the people who really thought about technology. And I think it's very easy to say, if you're against this technology, where do you draw the line? Are you against like having a fireplace? And it's not. I'm not. But there is a difference between high technology and low technology, which is something like what can be fulfilled by local resources and, say, a country's capabilities versus what requires the vast global interconnected system of capital and machinery and movement and technology. So, for example, like you can build a pitchfork or a shovel for your garden within Australia's capability, but building a mouse requires the complete global supply chain of all of the things, semiconductors and plastics. And there are different levels of technology, I guess, that we can think about. And I think AI represents another kind of evolution of that and another dependence on the global supply chain of semiconductors and plastics and machinery and computation. And so there's an opportunity to ask the question again.
These are big questions, and it's been fascinating to get some of your big thoughts on them. Niraj Lal, thanks so much for sharing your lab notes with me.
Thanks for having me.
This episode of Lab Notes was made on the lands of the Gadigal and Menang Noongar people. It was mixed by Antonia Gauci, presented by me, Jonathan Webb, and produced by Fiona Pepper. Catch you next week. Now, speaking of Fiona Pepper, as well as making Lab Notes, Fee has been working incredibly hard producing and co-presenting another show. And if you're not already following the Radio National podcast Science Friction, The Challenger Legacy, please go and put it in your list. It explores the terrible tragedy that struck the Challenger space shuttle 40 years ago, how it changed the history of spaceflight in a single moment, and the crucial lessons that we can still learn from it. This week was episode 3, where Fiona and Carl revisit the second space shuttle tragedy that struck in 2003 when Columbia fell apart on its way back to Earth. I'm going to leave you with a little taste of that story.
They could have called up the various three-letter agencies in the United States, National Security Agency, you name it, National Signals Intelligence Agency. The people who run U.S. spy satellites had more than enough capability to zoom in on that shuttle leading edge wing and could have seen if there was damage. And there were people at NASA asking the upper management of the shuttle program, the mission management team as it is called, to do just that, and they refused to do it.
The engineers were worried that the briefcase-sized foam piece had punched a hole in the left wing of the shuttle. And if that was the case, the wing wouldn't be protected against the extreme temperatures of re-entry.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.